its current state on WKAR. This week marks the 150th anniversary of the turning point of the American Civil War, the Battle of Gettysburg. During this week in 1863, General Robert E. Lee's all-out attempt to invade the North was turned down by the Union's Army of the Potomac, led by General George Meade. The battle ended with more than 50,000 killed and wounded. Michigan men suffered 40% casualties. Gettysburg sent the South on the road to its 1865 surrender. This week, WKAR presents a three-part series remembering the Battle of Gettysburg and Michigan's role in the war between the states. Here in Part 2, WKAR's Peter Wharf joins MSU history professor Roger Rosentrater at the MSU Museum to view and discuss the exhibit, Michigan in the Civil War. Roger and Peter begin their discussion at a few of the artifacts on display.
This is a doctor's kit. It's sort of a footlocker-sized box with a very intimidating-looking saw, some probes. Pretty major knives. And what else do we have in here?
Well, there are some probes. I do not have one of these in my collection, even though you can buy a reproduction kit if you really want to. But they do look pretty frightening, actually, when you think about it. And again, the amputations and the infection all being part of the process. There are some pretty frightening pictures after the war. The Surgeon General did a collection of the men who had recovered, survived, and exposing various limbs or what's left of them.
It says here, to treat a bullet wound, a doctor poked a finger into the wound searching for the bullet. If it was possible, he used these forceps here. These are about a foot long to reach in and try and pull it out.
Yeah, and just imagine, again, and these hospitals that are set up are sometimes set up literally set up anywhere. You can use a barn. So right away you can imagine the type of germs that are in the barn. Then the doctor is never washing off his hands, clearly, or any of the tools he's using, and he's taking his finger and probing it into the wound. The odds that anybody survives sometimes are amazing.
We're looking at some of the items here at the exhibit Michigan in the Civil War, the 150th anniversary, with Professor Roger Rosentrater, history professor at Michigan State University. We're talking about fixing men on the battlefield. Here's an item here used for fixing clothing and personal possessions.
Yeah, Peter, this is a great item because they're called a housewife, and it's just a sewing kit. And at the outbreak of the war, again, the Army doesn't provide its soldiers like it does today. I mean, yeah, they'll give you a uniform and a gun and a pair of boots or whatever, but beyond that, you really had to provide for yourself. So lots of women on the home front took it upon themselves to create various items for the soldiers, towels, socks, shirts. There was something called a havelock, which, if you can imagine, was kind of they don't have one on display here, but it was a draping over your kepi, your hat, so that you didn't burn the back of your neck. The soldiers never used them, and that's why you don't see them in the pictures. As a matter of fact, they didn't know what to do with them, and they got them by the literally thousands, and they might use them as a nightcap, or they might clean their weapon with them or whatever. And many of them finally said, don't send us any more of those things because we don't need them. But this housewife, this sewing kit, is an exceptional item on display here. It's identified to a Michigan soldier, and it's even got his name in there. And again, he had to take care of himself. I mean, there isn't anybody on the battlefield, certainly, or anyone going to do his sewing. He's going to have to do his own sewing. He can't go home. He can't go to the tailor, obviously. And if he needs to fix something, here's the item he would use. It is very nice. I've seen several. I own several. This one is as nice as I've seen.
Going to another item of everyday life, this appears to be actual food for soldiers from the Civil War.
Well, it does appear that way. And again, hardtack was the, I don't know if it was popular necessarily is a good way to describe it, but it was available certainly to Northerners, and it was just a cracker made out of flour and water. This particular label says there's lard in it. I've made hardtack for my students, and that's only flour and water and a little bit of salt. I've never put any lard in anything. But these were fairly, yes, you can imagine the name hardtack, so they're hard, right? But they weren't impervious to bugs. And they were called worm castles, as the label explains. And what the soldiers would do is, I mean, again, you couldn't discard them if you were provided with them. You had to make do, and soldiers were always hungry. So one of the ways they would deal with the problem was they'd create their coffee, and again, they didn't go to Beaners or anything like that. You know, if they were lucky, and they were usually Northerners had coffee, they would take their beans, and they'd have some hot water, and they'd put the beans in the bottom of their cup. They've got a cup on display here. Some of the cups were much larger, but they would just kind of break up the beans and pour in the hot water, as it were. Then they would take the hardtack, which is, again, not impervious to the bugs that are out there, break it up, put the hardtack in the coffee. Now, where are the bugs going to go? Well, they're going to seek to flee. They're going to come to the top, and then you use your spoon and you discard the bugs, and then you go on with your meal. So, sounds pretty appetizing, doesn't it?
Roger, what's amazing to me about this hardtack that is on display in the museum, if you can believe it, is it says this is actually still preserved from the Civil War, and it doesn't look too bad.
It doesn't. Matter of fact, I have bought it for my students. There is a Boston bakery that makes hardtack today than they did for the Union Army during the Civil War. And it looks pretty similar, to be honest with you. Well, I'd like to tell you that the Yankees won because of Michigan soldiers, but I guess that's an exaggeration. We sent 90,000 men to the war. That was 50% of our military-aged male population. As a lot of guys, right? And they fought in all the major campaigns and a lot of lesser campaigns as well. Again, there are plenty of stories of where Michigan men performed heroically, men and women, and that's something that I must confess we don't see here, but we should talk about at some point, is that the important role of Michigan women, because it sometimes, as is often the case, we think of war as being a male-oriented or male-only. Yes, the soldiers were largely male, but one of the best known, there were actually several women who served in the ranks from Michigan of the, on both sides. You know, some of the better known ones are from Michigan, as it turns out. But, you know, again, Michigan was a solid blue state, I guess I would say, right? It was a solid northern state. Its men went off and fought both in the Eastern Theater and the Western Theater of the war. They had served, you know, again, if we talk about generals, we certainly had our share. We had our Medal of Honor winners as well. Maybe we weren't any more unique than certain other states, but we certainly made a major contribution.
That's such a high percentage when you think about the time in history, and then you think about states like New York and Pennsylvania, maybe others like New Jersey, with, I would think, much larger populations.
Yeah. There were larger populations, certainly in those states, as you know, and one of the things that didn't happen here is that almost everybody from Michigan that served in the Union Army was a volunteer. Now, conscription was introduced in the war, and there were a few people from Michigan who were conscripted, but mostly it was volunteers, which again, conscription was designed to try to encourage volunteering, and it worked. But in Michigan's case, most of these guys signed up, even well into the war, when they knew just how horrendous things were. And there are good stories about, I can think of two brothers, for example, from the Detroit area. Well, the older brother went into the service, and then the younger brother wanted to follow, and the older brother said, "Hey, you don't know what you're missing. You know, just stay out." Well, as it turns out, the younger brother wasn't going to listen to the older brother, joined up, and the two brothers served in different units, and they both died at the Battle of Gettysburg. But again, that whole idea that even later in the war, you've still got plenty of men saying, "It's my duty, my responsibility." And that may seem hokey today, or maybe to some they think, "Oh, that's not." But that really seems to be the attitude. I've got a set of letters from a Michigan woman whose husband went off and served 2 years, and then he was going to stay on. And long story short, he came home after his three-year enlistment, and even late in that particular period of time, and she'd already lost a brother to the war, she said, "You know, we have to make this sacrifice. This Union means that much, that we all, be it her at home with a young child or her husband in harm's way, we all have to make this sacrifice." So if she's representative, and I'd like to believe she is, these Northerners took it very seriously.
Roger Rosentrater is history professor at Michigan State University. We've been looking at the exhibit, Michigan and the Civil War, the 150th anniversary. Professor Rosentrater, thanks very much.
All right, thank you, Peter. I appreciate it.
For Current State, this is Peter Whorf.